This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. You're listening to Law and Behold today, which is a series aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. So today we'll be talking about restoring our constitution's spirit of moderation and the role that our constitution plays in reflecting our interests and values as Malaysians. So with me in the studio are Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, as well as Surendra Anand, a constitutional lawyer. So welcome to the show today.
Hello. Thank you.
So perhaps let's just start with it, right? So we've suggested the title be on restoring the spirit of moderation in our constitution, but how do we have that spirit of moderation in the constitution to begin with?
Yes, indeed, our constitution was built on a spirit of moderation, accommodation, and tolerance. All constitutions are balancing acts. They seek to reconcile the existentialist, that is the existing reality, social, economic, religious, racial, with the ideals of the age. Our constitution was also built on these ideals as well as on the realities, a compromise, accommodation. And though with many, many faults, many, many flaws, I think all in all, we have to a large extent succeeded in maintaining a peaceful and prosperous nation, a nation of the middle path. I think that was what the constitution was about. I fully acknowledge there were many flaws, but we're a nation of moderation, accommodation, compared to many other countries in Asia and Africa, where tribal, religious, racial, caste, and regional conflicts engulf the nation. You see what happens in India. Kashmir was a special part of their federal arrangement with special rights, but the Indian Parliament amended the constitution to take away the special position of Kashmir. And there's a fair amount of bloodshed going on. Our example, on the other hand, is quite a contrast. We also have special regions, Sabah, Sarawak. They are unhappy with many things, and rightly so. We are having an MA63 meeting headed by the PM himself. Mm-hmm. And though the progress is slow, but there is some progress in trying to meet. Yes, I think our constitution was built on the spirit of accommodation and moderation.
Yeah, I think like Prof said as well, I think it's a very timely time now to talk about this topic and to remind everyone that moderation is actually not just clear from the history towards our constitution, but also in the provisions of the constitution itself. Just to give a few examples, number one, we have an express clause in the constitution that says that all persons are equal and that there shall be no discrimination on grounds of race and religion. And there can be no exception to this, mm-hmm. unless it is expressly provided for in the constitution, a provision which a lot of people often forget. It also does provide everyone with the right to profess and practice their religion. And while it does provide for the special position of the Malays and the natives of Sabah and Sarawak, but at the very same time, that provision also has a non-discrimination protection clause as well. And while the constitution does provide that Islam shall be the religion of the federation, again, many people forget that that very same article has a clause at the end that says that it shall not be used to derogate from other provisions in the constitution.
Oh, that's in Article 3, 4,
yeah.
Yes.
Which essentially means that you cannot use the provision saying that Islam is the religion of the federation to undermine the rights of others and to undermine fundamental liberties. So like Prof said, I think the constitution was a product of tolerance and a compromise between various societies and races. But ultimately, the product is one that expressly safeguards the interests and rights of all races in all religions, and that's something I think that escapes us often right now.
Yes, yeah, sadly, not only citizens, but even members of parliament, members of the political executive, the civil servants, have very low levels of constitutional literacy. Citizenship provisions are race and religious free. So under the Constitution, citizenship by operation of law or by naturalization or registration doesn't have any religious, racial or gender requirements. The electoral process is entirely gender or race or religion free. Anyone can contest, anyone can vote. Fundamental rights, Articles 5 to 13, are available to all. Federal posts, except for the Yang di Pertuan and the members of the Majlis Raja Raja Conference of Rulers, all federal posts are open to all. Education at the primary, secondary level is free to all. Financial assistance for education in the Constitution, it cannot be refused even to religious schools or to schools of other communities. Sabah Sarawak special rights are there, of course. Then along with Article 3, Clause 4, vernacular languages. 3, Clause 4 was about Islam does not derogate from other provisions. Vernacular languages are allowed. And in fact, under the Education Act, if 15 kids in a school want a particular language to be taught, the school has a duty to provide education in that vernacular language. Malay reserves are allowed, Article 89, but it says very clearly, no non-Malay land shall be converted to a Malay reserve. And if a certain amount of land is reserved for Malay reserves, an equivalent amount shall be opened up for general alienation. And I agree, Article 153 on the special position of Malays and natives is subject to 6 to 7 exceptions or explanations. For example, in 153 says very clearly, special position of the Malays and the natives of Sabah Sarawak and the legitimate interests of all other communities. So actually, the spirit of the Constitution was one of give and take. Everyone got something. No one got everything. The Constitution makers, our forefathers, walked the middle path of recognizing many indigenous features of the Malay archipelago, of the Nusantara. At the same time, they took note of the fact that this country was an incredibly diverse, plural society. And of course, also they took note of the democratic human rights era, which had reached our shores in the 50s.
So when we're talking about, you know, moderation, what do we mean by that? How would we, how does one define what moderation means?
Well, in very, very simple terms, moderation is lack of extremism, not only in your opinions, but also in your action. Moderation, to me, would imply that all point of views are merely from one particular point. There are many other points. So you should be prepared to listen to perspectives from other sides.
Mm-hmm.
You should not believe that truth is your monopoly. Actually, there are multiple truths. And moderation to me implies that we must try to be objective. And my favorite way of describing that is what the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, said. He said, to be truly objective, you must be subjective from the other person's point of view. In other words, I step in your shoes. I see the world through your eyes. I feel your pain. I think a moderate person must be prepared to listen to other views, other perspectives. A moderate person must not only show tenderness for his rights, he must show tenderness for the rights of others. A moderate person must understand the first function of freedom should be to free someone else. A moderate person must not only emphasize rights, must also emphasize responsibilities.
I think, yeah, Prof couldn't have put it better, but moderation just not does not mean just tolerating someone.
Mm-hmm.
It means accommodating someone as well.
Accommodating, yes.
It does not just mean let that person do what he wants to do, I'll tolerate it, but it's to accommodate and appreciate the difference. And maybe a simple example could be in an employment context. It's not just about maybe letting someone do something which is in accord with the religion, but to create an environment that can accommodate that person's practice as well, to make him safe and make him want to practice his religion. So ultimately, the team is more what you call reasonable accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is regardless of how bizarre or different you might find that other person's practice to be. And like Prof. Shard put it, it's about putting yourself in that person's position at the end of the day.
Mm. And it really shows what the importance of having the space for dialogue is, isn't it? So that you have all these point of views of people who can speak about all these things.
Yeah, respectful dialogue. Preparedness actually to go into conversations with others, listen to their views, not to feel threatened and not to threaten others. I face this dilemma. Sometimes we have religious beliefs or cultural beliefs which we strongly hold. At the same time, we have to accept that others, for example, as a Muslim, I can accept that others eat pig, but I cannot appreciate that for myself in the same way. So I think I would humbly submit moderation should be both tolerance and appreciation. But in some cases, appreciation may not be possible. It may simply be a case of, to you, yours beliefs, and to me, mine. But I'm not going to condemn you for that. I accept that these are your beliefs.
We do have to go for a short break. I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shard Salim Farooqi, Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, as well as Surendra Anand, a constitutional lawyer. We've been speaking about the spirit of moderation in our constitution. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. You're listening to an episode of our Law and Behold series, and today I'm speaking to Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shard Salim Farooqi, Professor of Constitutional Law at University of Malaya, and also Surendra Anand, who's a constitutional lawyer. And today we're talking about moderation in our constitution. So, moving on, often a lot of the voices that we hear when we talk about social issues are mostly heard from Peninsular Malaysia rather than East Malaysia. And even then, sometimes the voices that we hear on the mainstream media is not necessarily representative of all peoples in Peninsular Malaysia. But how does the Constitution ensure that these voices are heard?
Actually, the Constitution grants freedom of speech, Article 10, Clause 1A. But of course, it says speech can be restricted on specified grounds.
Mm-hmm.
In Parliament, Dewan Raya, Dewan Negara, there is parliamentary privilege, freedom of speech, subject only to the law of sedition. In the Senate, there are two senators from each state. And the impact of that is that actually in the Senate, states' voices should be heard. Now, I fully acknowledge that's not always done. That's not always successful, but I think the Constitution was built to allow freedom of speech, except in relation to the prohibited grounds, which are specified under the Constitution.
But what are the challenges in ensuring that the Constitution sufficiently represents all Malaysians?
Well, I think the Constitution, the challenges the Constitution will face, I think one of it may be what we are seeing now is that I would say maybe abuse is much of a strong word, a lesser word, I suppose, of freedom of expression. And a lot of people seem to form the view that, well, this freedom is unlimited and there are certain exceptions. But what you note from these exceptions are they're quite generally worded.
Mm-hmm.
And there are instances now where people are overusing this freedom to create tension among races and a lot of extremist views being put out. For example, the most recent example was this whole issue on Zakir Naik, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't really want to go into the details. There's investigations going on. But let's just look at hate speech, for example. That's something that can be very divisive. The Constitution actually does provide protection against hate speech. So in international law, for example, hate speech, states are obligated to take steps to prevent and address hate speech. So if there's a particular speech that can be construed as affecting public order, for example, then the state is obligated to take steps to restrict that speech. So it is in this sense that the Constitution balances on one hand the freedom of expression, and on the other hand, the need for moderation. So while it does allow you to speak about things, to criticize things, to do a lot actually, but when you take that too far, and you could cause riots or some other form of public disorder with your speech, then there is an obligation on the government to take steps to address that scenario. And I think this is where the balance is struck.
Yeah, I would like to add to that. I totally agree that freedom per se has no value. It's what freedom is for. It's the use to which it is put. It's the sense of responsibility with which it's exercised. In a civilized society, there should be no hate speech. We have no right whatsoever, no matter how powerful we are, how educated we are, to insult other races or religions or genders or regions. I totally agree with that. However, I just wanted to point out something here. There is no dearth of laws to punish hate speech. Besides the Sedition Act, there are plenty of provisions in the Penal Code. The Multimedia Communications Act has provisions. So the law is there. However, justice is not in legislation. Justice is in administration. Also, I want to point out to you this phenomenon of hate speech that we are witnessing. It's a despicable phenomenon indeed. But the problem is this, that the press tends to sensationalize acts of hatred and hooliganism rather than acts of kindness. And actually, these acts of kindness are 100 times more than the acts of hate speech or criminal defamation. The other problem is this. Internet today gives wings to negative speech. 10 years ago, if I said something despicable, well, it was between me and those to whom I had addressed. Now you just put a WhatsApp unthinkingly, and then after that, it is just spread. Third factor, and this is the silver lining behind the dark cloud, is actually Malaysian society is in transition from an authoritarian society to a democracy. Freedom is in the air, and a lot of people are exercising this freedom of speech, but irresponsibly. So I hope that in the years to come, there'll be better sense of balance between freedom and responsibility. But I think a lot of what is happening today is an exercise by people not used to freedom, suddenly gaining the freedom and not knowing what to do. Democracy must deal with undemocratic elements in a democratic way. There may be a lawless person, and yet you have to deal with him in a lawful way.
So whose responsibility does it fall then to behave in moderation? Does it fall on the people themselves, or should there be laws to sort of police them?
I think the responsibility belongs to both. It's totally wrong to believe that the government alone has the duty to curb this, though of course that's the job of the government. Please bear this in mind, that in modern society, power has shifted everywhere. Power has shifted from the official centers of power to private centers of power. Your station has power to promote tolerance and moderation. The media, NGOs, and many other groups.
So yeah, I think it's all levels, but like Prof said earlier, let's start at a very general level, at a government parliamentary level. Prof pointed out the laws that we have to restrict free speech. We have the Sedition Act. We have a very vague provision in the Communications Act. We don't have a specific law to deal on hate speech, national unity, etc. So that's more at a government level. And obviously, it's also about administering that law. But it doesn't stop there. So, for example, the government could take steps to, let's say, deal with an extremist who is inciting violence, inciting discrimination. But you're going to have so many other extremists around. And the root of the problem goes back to society at the end of the day. And we need to find that what is the root of the problem. And in my view, to me, that goes back down to the education system. We don't have topics on human rights. We don't have topics on equality. Nothing like this is being taught to our students from a young age. And this is something I think the government should be paying much attention to, so that as a society, from young, we are taught about moderation. it is good that a lot of the media and people like us are talking about it. Like even now we are talking about it.
Mm.
But who is our audience right now? They're most of the people who are already out of the education system are people who are working adults. If someone who has already formed their views, who have maybe a very extremist views, are going to be hearing this, what are the odds of them changing those views at a time when they're already working adults? I don't think it's likely that they might change their views. They could,
mm-hmm.
but I think the chances are low. What we need to be looking at is the future society. So it's good, like Prof said, the social media, internet, yes, there are the negative side to it. But the positive side to it as well is that younger adults are being exposed to a lot more things at a much younger age. This material could be bad and could be good. But if they know and if they're matured enough and if they're well-educated from a young age, I think they're less likely to be affected by the really bad extreme material out there. Right now, they're likely to just absorb what they get, form their own views.
Mm-hmm.
Comes to a time where it's too late to change them because they're already down a path they can't come back out of. And that's largely because the current system doesn't allow them to make informed choices at a young age.
So you mentioned the system, but what about the role of parents and teachers as well in this aspect?
Yeah, I think that is also important. And I've also seen a lot of scenarios where in public, the child might say certain racist things, racist remarks to another race, and you see the parents is not doing anything about it. Just keeping quiet, instead of telling the child that it's wrong, they just tolerate it, and just like that. Which is why if the child is getting that from the family environment, they're going to bring that to the school environment. And then if nothing is being done at the school level to sort of correct this or to maybe try and change this, then you're going to just let this whole thing fester. And the child is going to be then growing up in the environment, both at home and at school, to a point where he becomes an adult, and it's just going to be entrenched there.
Yeah, surely it's all interconnected. Actually, if parents at home use racist language, language that insults the other, by whatever you define the other, I agree, the children will grow up that way. These children will then one day become school teachers. I've had my kids come back home and said, Che Gukata cannot send Christmas cards to Christians because that is haram. And I have to tell them that no, your Che Gu, most respectfully, I have to say, is wrong on this issue. Building bridges with others, holding hands, showing respect for their traditions has nothing whatsoever to do with not being a good Muslim. So I agree that it's all connected. Surely citizens can play a role. So, for example, we must familiarize ourselves with the ethnic provisions of our constitution, which, as we mentioned earlier, were meant to walk the middle path. We must recognize diversity as an asset rather than as a curse. We must recognize that our cultures are intermingled and interdependent. I have to say this to you with some sadness and shame. Most of us in this country, or many of us in this country, are in denial about our mixed heritage. Mm. If we could recognize our mixed heritage, we could begin to see the other as a distant or a close cousin. We must recognize and acknowledge our multiple identities. I'm not just a Muslim or a male. I'm also a law teacher. I'm also a member of a neighborhood, member of a club or a society or a profession. So we have multiple identities. There is no need to see everything through the lens of religion or of race. Once you begin to acknowledge your multiple identities, you then actually walk in the meadow of life with people from many other races and religions. And that's the best way to learn. We must differentiate racism from race consciousness. So I think citizens can definitely play a role in all these things. We must recognize the rights of all. We must indulge, as you said earlier, respectful social engagement while venerating our own religion. We must not put down other religions. I think citizens certainly can play a role coming to government. Suren pointed out about the need for a law. May I just add a little bit to that? I would much rather, some people are saying they want a hate speech law. Mm-hmm. I would much rather put it positively. I would rather say we should have a
national harmony law. Put it more positively rather than to say hate speech law. That implies something negative. I would rather that there is a national harmony law, the first attempt of which should be to bring people together, to give education. Most prejudices are born out of ignorance, of being unwilling or unable to see the world from the other person's point of view. In other words, if someone is a frog under a coconut shell, he doesn't see other point of views. The first attempt is to try to rehabilitate them. Only if that fails, conciliation, education, then there should be the penal provision of the law. And, you know, penal provision need not mean jail sentence. It could be community service. So I would say government certainly must play a role. To me, the most important thing is equal harassment under the law. Equality not only means equal protection, it means equal harassment. And I'm sorry, on that point, we have not done a good job.
Yeah.
We tend to be rather selective in both our protection and in our harassment under the law.
And, you know, we mentioned this earlier, speaking of the law, you know, we have clauses in the law that provide for the preservation of distinctness of our cultures, of our language. But do you think that that just creates a space for potential divisiveness, or could that be a strength?
Well, sure, surely it's potential for divisiveness. There are middle paths possible. As I said earlier, I'm of the view that the Malaysian formula for permitting people to remain close to their religion, to their race, to their language, to their region, and yet have some commonalities, I think that was a winning formula. I know many people say vernacular schools are divisive. Many people would rather do what some other countries do, where everyone has national type of names. We don't insist on that. Now, I wish to humbly recommend middle paths. I think we can have vernacular medium, provided there are lots of common subjects. For example, BM should be a common subject. English should be a common subject. But there's, in my personal view, no harm whatsoever in having education in public schools supported by the taxpayer, in education in your own religion, in your own culture, in your own history. I think we can all be friends only in spots, SPOTS. In other words, in some areas. In others, I think we should be allowed to have distinctiveness. I take note, in a rainbow, the colors are separate, but not apart.
I think I share Prof's thought on distinctiveness, but my personal view is that although at this point in time, I think, and this is personal, I know the Constitution allows the establishment of vernacular schools, but I think we should be trying to move towards a national school system which maintains and encourages the distinctiveness by providing medium to study your own culture, your own religion, your own language. But the environment has to be such where it's multiracial in nature. And what we're having now is an education system where we are pretty much being divided by race. And I think one way to address it is to have a national school system which can maintain the education of your own religion, your culture, your language as well.
Actually, I fully agree with that. I don't mean to be different on this. You can call the school by any name.
Mm.
The content should be such that there must be a lot of commonalities. Mm. But within that content, you should allow distinctiveness. But the most important part is this: the composition of the students, the composition of the staff must be national. Sadly, most of the national schools have become religious schools. And then, of course, there are the vernacular schools, which are predominantly of one race. If kids don't learn together, how will they live together? I don't think Surya and I are very far apart on this issue. I think schools, by whatever name called, should have mixed population of students, mixed population of teachers, and a syllabus that permits diversity.
And in this respect, why is constitutional literacy important in ensuring a moderate spirit in our constitution?
And I think that the very reason is what we have now, that is a misunderstanding or misconception that there can be or there is a superior race or a superior religion, or this whole idea of we should be treated better than you, or this whole concept, like how Prof puts it, the concept of the other and this divisiveness, I think is partly or substantially due to the lack of constitutional literacy from a young age. And I think it's because of that that people tend to immediately listen to what other people tell them, may it be through social media or through lectures or preaching or whatever, and they accept it as it being the truth. Where else, like what we've been talking about, if you actually look at the Constitution, that paints a completely different picture. It quite clearly says that all of us are equal, each of us are allowed to practice and profess our religions, while there is a special position for certain races, but nevertheless, it's underpinned by non-discrimination. So if someone were to look or just read through the Constitution and understand all this, then at least one can then make an informed decision when confronted with hate speech or people who are trying to divide you. At least you can say, well, hold on for a moment. That does not really jive well with what our Constitution says. As much as you're trying to tell me that there is a more superior religion, but look, I don't think that is right. But you just don't have this kind of education right now. So when a child is being exposed from a young age to all these things, you can't really blame that child if that's what's going to be entrenched when he grows up. I think this has to be inculcated at an early stage. So I think that's where constitutional literacy will, I think, make a big difference for the society moving forward.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, Professor of Constitutional Law at University of Malaya, and also Surendra Anand, Constitutional Lawyer. If you've missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can download the podcast on our website, on our BFM app, or on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.